This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. We're broadcasting today from the Knight Studio at the Newseum in Washington, D.C.'s newest museum devoted to journalism and to the news business. Barack Obama pivots from Afghanistan to Iraq to Jordan and Israel. John McCain pokes fun at the Obama media love fest, but makes a few flubs along the way. And the New York Times says, get me rewrite to the Republicans' op-ed submission. It's Wednesday and time for our weekly visit with the political junkie.
There you go again. You
do that,
when I
president.
Hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
Although we weren't able to shatter that highest, hardest glass ceiling this time, thanks to you, it's got about 18 million cracks in it.
But I'm the decider.
NPR political editor Ken Rudin joins us every Wednesday to talk about the presidential campaign and other political news. This week, with the three network anchors in tow, Obama visits Iraq, Afghanistan, the Middle East, and later Europe. McCain hands out junior varsity cards to the reporters who stay behind to cover him. The two presidential hopefuls spar over the surge and over a timeline to withdraw combat troops, and could McCain's VP pick be just around the corner. Later in the program, former Ambassador Richard Holbrooke joins us to talk about his meeting in Belgrade with Radovan Karadzic. What do you do when you're introduced to a war criminal? But first, it's the political junkie. Ken Rudin is with us here as usual at the Newseum. And as usual, we begin with a trivia question.
Hi, Neil. Well, John McCain, he's that other guy running for president.
Oh, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Right. That's sometimes the media covers him. He's going to be in New Orleans tonight, and he's going to be meeting with the governor, Bobby Jindal. Now, Bobby Jindal is rumored to be on John McCain's vice president shortlist, because he's only about 5'2".
Exactly. He's shorter than McCain.
Exactly. And he's only 37 years old. So the question is, who was the last vice president younger than Bobby Jindal?
So if you think you know who the last vice president younger than 36 years
37,
old,
37
years
last
old,
month.
If you think you know the answer to that question, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And we'll also, of course, accept entries from here in the studio audience at the Newseum. And Ken, as you mentioned, it's been a little hard for John McCain to break through the nonstop media coverage of Obama's Mideast tour.
Well, you know, this is a year of bitterness. Everybody's bitter. We know that folks in Pennsylvania are bitter. They cling to guns and religion. We know that Hillary Clinton supporters are bitter because of Michigan and Florida. Now we know that the John McCain campaign is bitter, one, because they think it's nonstop fawning coverage, media coverage of Barack Obama. All three network anchors followed the presumptive Democratic nominee to his Mideast trip. But also, he's also upset that John McCain makes the case that his support, John McCain's support for the surge, is what made the situation in Iraq so acceptable for them to be talking about withdrawing troops. And he's resentful of the fact that Barack Obama, who mistakenly opposed, opposed the surge all this time, nonetheless is getting the benefits of McCain's policies.
And never getting the benefits of Iraq's Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, saying, Mr. Obama's timeline looks pretty good to me.
Right, of course, but he also has an Iraqi audience al-Maliki has to deal with, and saying, obviously, nobody wants American troops on your soil, so you have to try to appease that audience as well.
Ken's going to be with us to cover the Iraqi primaries, too.
Yeah,
so
the caucuses.
Get into that too.
The caucuses.
Yeah. Right. Anyway, it's been not just that issue over the media. The New York Times published an essay by Barack Obama just before he left on his trip saying, my Iraq plan. And John McCain submitted an op-ed to the New York Times with basically the same thing.
Right, and the New York Times circled it and said, please see me after class. They did not accept it, and they said obviously one of the reasons was they felt that McCain should further spell out his timetable, how he would get his troops out, things like that. But McCain, rather than ignoring it, actually leaked it to everybody, and he wanted to make the case, I guess, that again, once again, it's the media piling on. He also has a thing on his website. He has a video basically quoting all the journalists who have been fawning about Barack Obama, saying why the media is in the tank for Barack Obama. For John McCain to say that, that's pretty remarkable.
Anyway, we've got some people who think they know the answer to our trivia question. Let's go first to the phone, and let's try Mark on line two. Mark with us from Reno in Nevada. Hey, Mark.
Hello? Yes.
You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Well, I guessed Teddy Roosevelt.
Theodore Roosevelt, later President of the United States, but elected Vice President of the United States. Is he right, Ken?
No, Theodore Roosevelt was 41, but he's close. Theodore Roosevelt was 41 years old when he was elected under William McKinley in 2000.
So maybe,
I mean 1900.
1900. Maybe he went up on San Juan Hill. He was the right age. But thanks anyway.
I appreciate it.
Let's see if we can try on line three. And this is Chris in Reno, Nevada. And Chris, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi, Neil.
Hi.
I'll take a guess and I'll say it's Dan Quayle.
There are many superlatives applied to the Dan Quayle vice presidency, but youngest I don't think is one of them, Ken.
Although he seemed very young when George H.W. Bush picked him, actually. A lot of people thought he was 17 at that time, but no, Dan Quayle was older, but he had that youthful look, but it's not Dan Quayle either.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, Chris.
Thank you.
And let's see if we can go now to line four. And line four has John from Buffalo in New York. Hey, John.
Hi.
Who do you think?
It's John C. Breckinridge in 1856.
You get the Google Award this week. Congratulations.
That's correct.
How did you know that? Did you look that up on the internet?
I'm a history buff. I just knew it off the top of my head.
He was 30. Breckinridge was 36 years old when he became vice president in 1857. The youngest in the 20th century was Richard Nixon, who was 39.
Many superlatives apply to his vice presidency, too. But, John, congratulations. You win this week's No Prize.
Thank you.
All right. Appreciate it. Anyway, Ken, it's not just the media. Some of the slips that John McCain has been making have been finally coming to the fore. John McCain got his geography mixed up in an interview this week on ABC's Good Morning America. And we're going to hear that in just a moment.
And as you know, he just received his first briefing ever from General Petraeus, and he declared his policy towards Iraq before he left. And so the fact is we have made progress and we have succeeded, and we will be coming home, my friends. Our troops will be withdrawing, but they'll come home in honor and victory. They will not come home in defeat.
That was John McCain at his town hall meeting in New Hampshire, where he didn't make any geographical slips. We may hear that cut later.
But on Good Morning America, he did talk about the Iraqi-Afghanistan border, and obviously there is no Iraqi-Afghanistan border. Perhaps he was thinking Afghanistan-Pakistani
border.
But the point is, it's the kind of things like that when he talks about things like Czechoslovakia, which has not existed in many, many years, when he seemingly confused Sunnis and Shiites when he was visiting the Mideast with Senator Lieberman. Those are the kind of things that, you know, given the fact, I mean, we don't have to pile on here, but he's going to turn 72 years old, the oldest person, if he were to be elected, the oldest person ever elected president, and it's the kind of things that make people at least just stop and think.
And also people say if Barack Obama had made those mistakes, they would have been looped on Fox News as evidence of his inexperience.
Well, the Obama people are convinced that McCain is getting favorable coverage, and the McCain people are convinced that the Obama people are getting favorable coverage, which makes you think that the coverage is probably pretty fair.
A lot of the attention this week focused on Senator Obama's trip to Iraq and Afghanistan. He was accompanied by Senators Jack Reed and Chuck Hagel. Well, joining us now is Representative Christopher Shays, of Connecticut, who knows all about congressional trips to that part of the world. As the senior Republican on the House National Security and Foreign Affairs Committee, he's visited 20 times in Iraq since the invasion, and he joins us now on the line from Capitol Hill. And Congressman Shays, nice to have you on the program again.
Nice to be on the program, but I can't imagine anyone saying the coverage has been fair.
Well, be that as it may, sir, I wanted to ask you, when you go on these trips, how much control do you as a member of Congress have over what you see and the people you meet?
Well, the first four trips, I had a lot of control because the Defense Department didn't want me to come in, and I went through with State Department, and I basically went outside the umbrella of the military. But the bottom line is you make requests. And then they decide whether they can grant the requests that you want. When I come in, I want to meet with our own military, but I particularly want to meet with Iraqis. And so sometimes you can't see the Iraqis you want to see, and sometimes you can't go to the places you want to go.
How much access do you get to people like General David Petraeus, and do you often get the personal helicopter tour over Baghdad?
Well, when you say the personal helicopter tour over Baghdad, I've never had a personal helicopter tour over Baghdad. What we do is we go in on a helicopter to different sites. Sometimes they can be an hour and a half away. They can be 2 hours away. Sometimes we go by plane. But they take us to the places we request. And in the beginning, when we came to the airport, we went by vehicle through what was no man's land, and that was not a pleasant experience because they would be driving about 90 miles an hour and weaving at the same time. But we can, then the more you go, obviously, the more contacts you make and the better opportunity you have to design the trip the way you want to design it. I have a retired colonel on my committee staff, and he designs the trip the way we want and then gets concurrence from DOD and sometimes state.
And obviously conditions have improved over the past year dramatically.
That's an absolute understatement. They have truly improved.
And so that the senators were able to go to places like Ramadi and meet in Anbar province, which when you first went out there would not have been possible.
The example that the reason I go every 3 to 4 months is so I can see whether the trend line is up or down. We made huge mistakes in 2003, and I would come back and complain about one mistake after another. I mean, just simply firing all of their military and putting them out on the street. I would have Iraqis say, why are you putting my husband, my brother, my cousin, my nephew, my son out of work? Why can't they at least control, guard a hospital? You would come back with that. You would meet our troops and see the pathetic protection they had in the beginning. When we started out, we didn't even have the Humvees with sides on them, much less armor, because they always underestimated what the challenge was. By the time I got in 06, I was absolutely convinced we were going to lose this war if we didn't have a timeline. But you get that from visiting with people and talking with them.
And do you think, we just have a few seconds left with you, but do you think that you're able to get a real important and significant picture on these trips where obviously you're under security all the time?
Well, first off, you're not going to get it accurate picture just going once because you have nothing to compare it to. So you don't know if things are getting better or worse. But if you go every 3 to 4 months, you know if things are getting better or worse. So in 06, I saw things deteriorate just by my trips. In 07 and 08, things have vastly improved.
Congressman Shays, thanks very much for your time today. We appreciate it. Christopher Shays of Connecticut, the top Republican on the House National Security and Foreign Affairs Subcommittee, joined us by phone from Capitol Hill. More with political junkie Ken Rudin in just a moment, and we'll talk about charges of lopsided coverage in the media and about the Republican veep stakes with Republican strategist Vin Weber, who joins us in just a moment. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to be with us. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. We're broadcasting today from the Knight Studio inside the Newseum in Washington, D.C. NPR's political editor Ken Rudin is with us. He's our political junkie every Wednesday, and you can read his political junkie column on NPR's website at npr.org. This week, Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons hit the airwaves again, this time in a McCain campaign ad spoofing the supposed media swoon over Barack Obama.
The media's love affair with Barack Obama is all-consuming.
The feeling most people get when they hear a Barack Obama speech, I felt this thrill going up my leg. I don't have that too often.
The biblical term for it, since we're in a biblical era, is deliverance. We're being picked up and moved to where we have to be.
What percentage of the mainstream media is in the tank for Barack Obama?
Oh, by 90%.
And that was on John McCain's website, poking fun at the reported media love fest over Barack Obama. Joining us here at the Newseum is Republican strategist Vin Weber. And, Vin, nice to have you back on the program.
Great to be here.
And, John McCain jealous over somebody else's media coverage.
I think that's unfair. I'm not upset at all. And I'm really pleased to be here with the only two journalists in America not traveling with Barack Obama.
The JV team,
yes, absolutely. The Scribinis.
Well, look, it's... there are reasons why this is a big story. He's a unique candidate in American history. I would have to say he's a uniquely inexperienced candidate in American history. And that makes his trip abroad all the more interesting. And Senator McCain did prod him into going because he hasn't been in Iraq for so long. or Afghanistan ever. So I understand why they're covering it a lot. The thing that matters to me the most is not so much the volume of coverage that he's getting, but whether or not they're asking him some tough questions. And I have to say, first of all, I think he's done well on this trip, but the journalists have asked him some tough questions. Terry Moran's interview on ABC about his, in my judgment, utterly illogical position that the surge had worked and I would not have voted for it even if I'd known it was going to work. I don't get that at all, but Terry was very tough on him. And Katie Couric followed up with a fairly tough interview, too. So the volume of coverage is hard to argue with. The main thing is he going to get some tough questions? Is he going to get some? That plagued Hillary Clinton, too. Remember the Saturday Night skit where they sort of set off the first round of commentary about the fact that Barack Obama was the media's love child and that he wasn't getting any tough questions. She got all the tough questions.
Well, I do recall that the Romney campaign was not too thrilled with the media's treatment of John McCain on the Straight Talk Express. They thought the media was in John McCain's pocket. He called them his base at one point.
I think that was back in the 2000 campaign when he had... I mean, the people traveling on the Straight Talk Express were not quite as numerous as those on Barack Obama's airplane now. But McCain used to be the darling of the media. Romney, people thought he got a lot of breaks. I don't know. It is always frustrating. I've been in a position where I've been critical of the media for coverage, too. And yet it seems that the voters sort it out. I would be hard-pressed to think of an election where I thought that media bias determined the outcome of an election. Doesn't make it any less irritating when it happens, but you know, all of my conservative colleagues and friends are always the most critical of media coverage, and I always say, yeah, I agree with you. How did Reagan ever get elected twice? Somehow the voters managed to see through all this, and I think that they will in this case, too.
Now, let's see if we get some callers in on the conversation, and let's go to line two, and Pat is with us. Pat calling from Prescott, Arizona.
Hi, good day. I wanted to... point out that a bunch of these reporters and stuff, you know, they basically go to barbecues and stuff with McCain, so I think it's ludicrous to say that he gets bad coverage. And
I wasn't saying, also, nobody said bad coverage, I think less coverage is what they were saying.
Less, well, I think that's kind of implicit in the assumption. And if you remember, there was an AP press function maybe a couple months ago, and when they went there, McCain, basically, they gave him some donuts and all this stuff, and when they announced Obama being there, they called him Osama. So I think that's pretty, you know, I don't think McCain has any reason to criticize, you know, after the fawning coverage he's got basically since 2000 from the press. So.
Some of those details, Vin, may be elusive, but...
The donut Osama connection somehow got past me, but I do think it's quantifiable, though. At least I've seen studies that say it's quantifiable.
Rosenstiel, the Project for Excellence in Journalism.
Barack Obama is getting a lot more coverage than John McCain. And you might say that some of that is justifiable up to a point because of the uniqueness of his candidacy, but it's a little bit over the top. I do think that it'll straighten out and even out in the course of the campaign. And as I said a minute ago, I just have some confidence that the country sorts it out for itself.
Thanks very much for the call, Pat.
And in fairness, so what's going on this week? I mean, this is a historic trip. Barack Obama meeting all the heads of state in Israel and the Middle East and things like that. And for John McCain, for what he's doing, I mean, he rode on a golf course with George Bush in Maine.
George H.W. Bush,
right, former president. And so, in other words, if you look at the news events of this week, certainly it makes sense that there's more coverage on Obama.
Right. I thought the press was way too tough on McCain with George H.W. Bush. Maybe it's because I was in Congress when the senior Bush was president. I'm a great admirer of his. And I didn't see anything wrong with Senator McCain going up to pay a visit to a fairly beloved elder statesman of the Republican Party.
There just
Party.
Was no news.
There wasn't any news,
but the
coverage focused a lot on age. It talked about an older candidate meeting with a still older former president. I just thought, you know, they could have done better than that.
And getting back to the issue of age, we mentioned earlier, Senator McCain has made a couple of flubs in recent weeks, and we're going to hear one of them. I hope this time, again, this is John McCain on ABC's Good Morning America.
But there's a lot of things we need to do. We have a lot of work to do, and I'm afraid that it's a very hard struggle, particularly given the situation on the Iraq-Pakistan border.
And that's not the only one.
I think you got it right, though. He clearly meant the Afghan-Pakistan border, because we talk about it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
This is not an obscure point of discussion if you talk about the security problems of the Middle East. He got the wrong word in his mind, and he meant Afghan-Pakistan. So, because of his age, anytime that he makes even a trivial slip, that's going to bring up this discussion, and he's just got to live with that. But I think John McCain has performed well as a candidate, and I'm not worried about the age issue.
You're not worried about the age issue
at all?
I'm
really not.
He has certainly shown no lack of vigor. He campaigns hard, very hard.
Very hard, very hard, very vigorously. I just think that's going to show through, and people will sort that out too, and they'll decide this election on the basis of something, but not that.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, and also McCain has also made the point that he has media coverage like round the clock, and so of course with 24-hour coverage and his access to the media, of course he'll make far more mistakes than Barack Obama, who is less prone to meeting with the media than McCain is.
Well, quite a bit less prone. I mean, he protects himself quite a bit on the trail. I think I've heard from a lot of my reporter friends who probably admire him that they're very frustrated with the lack of any kind of real access to Barack Obama.
Let's see if we get another caller on the line. Let's go to line 5, and this is Brad. Brad with us from Kalamazoo in Michigan.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Okay, great. I am a young voter. This will be my first presidential election that I'll be able to vote in. And one thing that I've noticed is that I've had to look extra hard to find anything on McCain. Anytime I do any internet research or anything, which, you know, I'm doing every day, I always listen and watch everything as much as I can get. It's, you know, there's always Obama on every front page, but I just have trouble finding stuff on McCain sometimes, unless it's stuff about his mistakes that he made between the Iraq and Pakistan border. I think you were just talking about that and things like that. And while I'm oftentimes carting my friends over to get registered to vote because, you know, my generation sometimes isn't as prone to do that. And a lot of times people don't even know who Obama's running against. And I also have noticed, on the other hand, that what you were just talking about how Obama, you don't hear many direct quotes from him. And I've wondered if that's because he's not necessarily the best with thinking on his feet. The one that I've heard recently was the one with his vice presidential search committee,
mm-hmm.
And he was trying to explain that, and I couldn't even understand what he was trying to say.
After Jim Johnson's left the campaign. Well, he just had a news conference yesterday in Amman, Jordan, and though I think it's perfectly fair to say, clearly Barack Obama is less available to the media and clearly speaks less extemporaneously than John McCain.
His interactions with the media are more conventional. They're the way that most politicians interact with the news media, at least when they get to the presidential level. They try to structure them so they can prepare in advance and stand in front of a camera.
And stay on message.
And stay on message. And John McCain has been very unique in his presidential campaigns, both 2000 and now, in not doing that. He sits down on the bus or in a coffee shop or anywhere else and lets people ask him any questions he wants. And that has served him very well, but occasionally, you know, things slip out.
Mm. Thanks, Brad.
As a question, do you think that has to do with how some people associate him with George Bush and how he did not do that so much when he was running?
Well, I think this is McCain. This is just pure McCain. When he was running in 2000, he invented this. I don't think, as I recall it, his advisors were not uniformly enthusiastic about John McCain doing this when 8 years ago. But McCain insisted this is who he really is. He really wants, he believes he is the straight talker. He's not afraid to answer people's questions, and he does believe the voters ultimately will sort out the little mistakes that come and think that the greater good of actually having a president who's willing to talk to people and answer real questions is the greater good.
Brad, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it. There was some speculation this week that John McCain might try to cut through the media blitz on Obama by naming his vice presidential candidate. At least Robert Novak thought so and said he'd be find out later if what he got was either hype or reality, and apparently ran down the source on the streets of Washington this morning.
That was vicious.
Well, there was an accident.
From
what you know, who's on the short list for Republican vice presidential nomination?
Well, I can tell you who we all think is on the short list. I can also tell you there's only one person who knows who's on the short list, and that's John McCain. But most people say that the ones on the short list are my governor, Tim Pawlenty, and my friend Mitt Romney, and Governor Jindal from Louisiana. Those are the three names that keep coming up again and again and again. There are other names that circulate, but they kind of have drop off from time to time.
Heard Rob Portman of Ohio.
Rob is always sort of on the list. I think the world of him. He's an enormously able guy. I have not heard as much speculation about him of late, but that doesn't mean he's not on the list. I come back to the point. Nobody really knows here except John McCain. And maybe he's breathed a little bit to his inner circle of advisors, Rick Davis, the campaign manager, and Steve Schmidt and Charlie Black, and probably his wife, Cindy. But beyond that, it's fairly, you should discount by a substantial degree any kind of rumor that you hear, because nobody really knows except the candidate. It's one decision that he can make all by himself.
Ken?
It reminds me of the great New York Post headline that John Kerry picked Gephardt on the front page.
Yes,
when
right,
the first day
that.
He picked John Kerry, John Edwards. But first of all, my new pick is Pawlenty. I think it will be Pawlenty. I was saying Portman all along, but a lot to do with McCain has to do with his, like, you know, his comfort zone. And obviously, there's always been a question about whether he's comfortable with the Mitt Romney.
Right.
He apparently is very comfortable with the Tom Ridge, who just happens to be pro-choice on abortion. Any way in the world that McCain picks a pro-choice one, he might.
I think it's highly unlikely. Tom Ridge is a good friend of mine. I'm a great admirer of his. I think he would be a great running mate. His problem to be on the abortion issue goes beyond the fact that he's pro-choice, which will be a problem for anybody that you picked on the Republican side. But he's a Catholic from Erie, and his bishop denies him communion. So you've got a specific problem with, you know, conservative Catholic voters that, you know, McCain would just have to decide if he wanted to you know, sort of live with that and defend that throughout the campaign. But beyond that, the Republican convention is going to be a pro-life convention. They're not going to be happy with a pro-choice running mate. If that running mate adjusted his positions or said simply he was going to defer to the president's positions, you might be able to get by it. Remember that George Herbert Walker Bush had a more pro-choice position in 1980 than Ronald Reagan did. And he basically said when he was picked as vice president that he was going to conform his position to Ronald Reagan's position.
We're talking with political junkie Ken Rudin and Vin Weber, former congressman from Minnesota, now a Republican strategist and a lobbyist here in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a question from here in the audience at the museum.
Hello, my name is Cassie Loski. I'm from Columbus, Nebraska. There's been a lot of criticism from conservatives, especially religious conservatives, that McCain is not conservative enough, that he's too moderate. What can he do to win back the conservative, especially religious conservative voters? Will the VP make a difference?
Sure, the VP will make a difference, but let me just make a point. There's been a lot of discussion about John McCain's, quote, problems with evangelical voters, but it doesn't really show through in the polls very much. I read something on, I think, under David Brody's byline on CBN the other day that showed, according to the Pew Research, some Pew Research done, that John McCain is today stronger with evangelical voters against Obama than either Kerry or Gore were, than Bush was against Kerry or Gore. He's actually doing pretty well. He has a few leaders of that community that have been notably critical of him. Dr. Dobson, for instance, said he wouldn't vote for him at one time. Now he started to change his mind a little bit. But at the grassroots level, they've come together pretty strongly behind John McCain. And we're not so much worried about the percentage of the vote that goes to him. We are, of course, on the Republican side, worried about turnout. We're worried about what percent of the total voters go to the polls. And that's an issue broader than the evangelical community. But the choice of vice president matters. Then there are some issues that really resonate with those voters as well. The judiciary is a very big issue because that's where we've been deciding, unfortunately, in my view, a lot of these social issues for about 30 years now. And John McCain will have some very, very good issues to raise. And, you know, frankly, everybody doesn't like the hot-button issue of abortion, but Obama's position on abortion is really quite extreme, even by standards of the last several elections. In Illinois, he voted against a bill that would have required the saving of the life of a baby born live in an abortion. There are a small number of such instances where the baby is not aborted, where it's born live, and he voted against requiring the saving of the life of that baby. That puts him in about as extreme a position with pro-life voters as anybody they've ever seen. And I think, you know, that some of that just has to come out a little bit more in the course of the campaign.
And then finally, we heard today that Ron Paul, the former Republican candidate, would be having a sort of convention of his own in Minneapolis.
Minneapolis, right.
Right in your backyard and going on at the same time the Republican convention's going on.
Well, I served with Ron Paul in the House, and I have to say I always liked him, and I admire him a lot. I'm not sure what he's trying to accomplish. I mean, he's not the candidate of any party, but he's trying to draw attention to a particular strain of conservative thinking. He says some things that resonate very well with conservatives, even if conservatives don't think they can quite go as far as he wants to in terms of really limiting the size and scope of government. It's sort of, oh, if only we could.
Mm-hmm.
But when he gets into foreign policy is when he loses most conservatives, because the libertarian view of foreign policy is just as restricted as the libertarian view of domestic policy. That is to say, they basically don't think there should be one.
Yeah. Or,
that's an overstatement. If Ron were here, he'd say I was being very unfair to him. But they are very limited in what they believe the U.S. government should do militarily, what it should do diplomatically. They're much more what we might have called isolationist.
Yeah, he raised an awful lot of money for president. At least he decided to spend it in Minnesota.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. The Minnesota economy is pretty good, but it can always be better.
Vin Weber, thanks very much, as always, for being with us.
Great
we
to
appreciate
be with
your
you.
Time today. Also with us today, of course, Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor, our political junkie here every Wednesday at the Newseum. Up next, we'll be talking with former Ambassador Richard Holbrooke about his meeting with Radovan Karadzic in 1995. Do you shake hands with a war criminal? I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Radovan Karadzic was arrested on Monday in Belgrade after nearly 13 years on the run. One of the most wanted men in the world, Karadzic stands accused of genocide and crimes against humanity for his part orchestrating the siege of Sarajevo and the Srebrenica massacre during Bosnia's civil war. After extradition to the Netherlands, he'll stand trial at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia in The Hague. Karadzic adopted an alias, wore thick glasses, and grew a bushy white beard to disguise his identity, and worked openly in Belgrade as a doctor of alternative medicine. His arrest brings Serbia one step closer to admission into the European Union. In an op-ed for the Washington Post titled The Face of Evil, U.S. Ambassador Richard Holbrooke described his meeting with Radovan Karadzic as NATO airstrikes finally forced Bosnia's Serbs to negotiate. If you have questions about what Karadzic's capture means for Bosnia, for Serbia, and for war crimes tribunals, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Ambassador Richard Holbrooke was the chief architect of the Dayton Peace Agreement that ended the Bosnian War. He joins us now from our bureau in New York. It's nice to have you on the program today, sir.
Good to be with you.
And you met Karadzic just once in 1995. Can you describe that meeting for us?
We were on our fifth trip to Belgrade. The war was at an intense level. NATO bombers had been bombing the Bosnian Serbs for 2 weeks. Three of our colleagues had been killed. Bob Frazier, Joe Kruzel, and Nelson Drew had been killed on our first attempt to get into Sarajevo. The city of Sarajevo was under siege, and we came into Belgrade as we were bombing. And I said to my colleagues that I thought Karadzic and Mladic might be brought into the negotiations by Milosevic this time around. I shouldn't explain that we had deliberately cut Mladic and Karadzic out of the negotiations. They'd negotiated with a lot of other people, including Jimmy Carter. But we just thought bringing them in made it more odious. They were already indicted war criminals. So
Slobodan Milosevic, the president of Serbia, would later be indicted.
He would later be indicted. And we wanted to force him to take responsibility for the war he was bankrolling and not legitimize these terrible, terrible men. So we landed in Belgrade September 13, 1995. My negotiating team, General Wes Clark, Chris Hill, now the North Korea negotiator, myself, three or four other people. Sure enough, Milosevic took us out to an old hunting lodge outside Belgrade. And he said, Karadzic and Mladic are in a villa nearby. Would you be willing to see him? We had prepared for this, and we decided we would do it once and only once. But we laid down some ground rules to Milosevic. He would have to take personal responsibility for their conduct. If they gave us any crap, if they started lecturing us, we would walk out and the bombing would intensify. And then Milosevic said, okay. And then in the distance, as the fading light came over the countryside, we saw two men get out of their Mercedes and walk towards us across the field. They were just unmistakable, the stocky combat fatigue, Mladic walking as though he was walking through a mud field, and the taller man in a suit with that unmistakable shock of white hair, Radovan Karadzic. They came to us. I did not shake their hand. Some of my colleagues did. Others didn't. It was their choice. And we sat down to negotiate. And at the end of 13 hours, and after a great deal of drama, we had agreed that the siege of Sarajevo would be lifted the next day, and it was.
There was one, though, dramatic moment during those negotiations when you insisted that the siege of Sarajevo be lifted immediately.
Well, early on, Karadzic, of course, tested us, as we knew he would. He started yelling and screaming that Serbs were victims, they were being humiliated. He compared us to April 6, 1941, the day that Hitler had bombed the Serbs in Belgrade, a famous day in Serbian history. And I turned to Milosevic and I said, you know, you made an agreement with us that this wouldn't happen, and if it continues to happen, we're going to walk out and the bombing will intensify. And then I turned to Karadzic. Karadzic then said that he was a personal friend of Jimmy Carter's, and he had Carter's phone number, and he was going to go call Carter and get Carter involved. So for the only time in 13 hours, I spoke to Karadzic directly, and I said, listen, I worked for President Carter as Assistant Secretary of State. I respect him, but we only have one president at a time, and our president is Bill Clinton, and that's the only person we work for. And you go to call Carter, we're leaving, and the bombing intensifies. And Milosevic said something to him in Serb, and he sat down, and the negotiations proceeded. That day, I must tell you frankly, that day, the man who was much scarier was Ratko Mladic. One had the sense that Karadzic was the intellectual architect of ethnic cleansing. He really believed all the mythology about the Serbs that he was a purveyor of. But the mass murderer, the hands-on murderer, was Ratko Mladic.
And he, of course, is still at liberty somewhere in either Serbia or Bosnia-Herzegovina. And
absolutely. But I think this is a big deal. This was not, you know, your listeners need to really focus on something. 13 years, NATO failed to capture Karadzic. He was captured by the Serb government after an election in which the pro-Western government, Boris Tadic's government, was elected. I think the people of the world should know today that the hero of the story is Boris Tadic, a very brave man whose best friend, former Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic, was murdered after he had arrested Milosevic and sent Milosevic to The Hague. And I talked to Tadic a few months ago in a conference in Brussels, and he talked a great deal about Djindjic, and he talked about the danger to his life, and he's taken a very important step. It's going to help stabilize not only Serbia, but Bosnia.
And you also pointed out that this should boost the idea of war crimes tribunals, even though Mladic still and Karadzic for 13 years, unarrested after their indictment.
You're absolutely right. You know, 12, 13 years is a long time, and there's no excuse for taking this long, particularly since many, many people were in on the secret of hiding him and are still in on the secret of hiding Mladic. But what's important here is that even though it took this period of time, he never was free to come out in public. He had to do all this from the shadows. He was always under pressure. And other war criminals, and I'm thinking particularly of the president of Sudan, Mr. Bashir, who was indicted last week by the International Criminal Court, have got to understand after Karadzic's arrest that no matter how long it takes, once you're indicted, you are on the lam for the rest of your life. And it isn't just a few Nazi hunters as it was in the days when the Israelis went to Argentina and snatched Eichmann. Next time around, it'll be an international arrest warrant, as it was for Karadzic, as it is for Mladic, and as it now is for Bashir.
Let's get some listeners in on the conversation. We're talking with Ambassador Richard Holbrooke about his op-ed in the Washington Post today called The Face of Evil, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Let's go to line 3, and David's there. David calling us from San Antonio, Texas.
Hi. I'm calling because I'm trying to understand how an educated psychologist like Karadzic could somehow justify in his own head the need for ethnic separation of the different groups, and how he can somehow continue to propagate that and go along with, I guess, the leaders at that time and justify the ethnic cleansing, the killings that took place at that time. So I guess I'm trying to understand that I can see, you know, the common person that is maybe not as educated, not prepared, falling into the trap, into that propaganda. But here's this man who is supposedly quite well prepared academically, and yet behaves very, very irresponsibly. And I'm trying to understand, how is it that that person goes from that extreme into this criminal mind?
David, it's an excellent question. I guess the easiest answer is a degree, even from Columbia University, where Karadzic went to school, doesn't turn you into a smart person. There can be, if you'll pardon the expression, evil geniuses. The biggest evil genius in that sense was Goebbels. And Karadzic was in the Goebbels tradition, a mass communicator who preached race hate. It wasn't that he was stupid, it was that he was evil. And I use the word evil deliberately. President Bush really messed that word up with his phrase, axis of evil, for Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. But there are such things as evil, and the article which Neil referred to at the beginning of the program in today's Washington Post, I asked the Washington Post to have the headline, "The Face of Evil." Not the face of a bad guy, evil. There are evil people out there, and we shouldn't overuse the word as President Bush has used it, but this man was absolutely unmitigated evil.
Appreciate your comment. Thank you.
David, thanks very much for the call. We're talking with Richard Holbrooke, the chief architect of the Dayton Peace Agreement that ended the war in Bosnia. He writes a monthly column for The Washington Post, and there's a link to his latest, The Face of Evil, on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News. And Ambassador Holbrooke, going back to the issue, you mentioned the International Criminal Court. The United States is not a party to that agreement that doesn't participate in the ICC. Is it time to change that stance, do you think?
There were some problems with the ICC, which the Bush administration led them to repudiate the American signature on the treaty. President Clinton had signed it. Bush repudiated it. In the real world, however, the Congress is not going to ratify this treaty in its current form. You need 67 votes, as we all know, for a treaty, and it's not going to happen here. So I think there's some issues that need to be fixed on it from an American standpoint. There are just too many people out there who are afraid that an American official might be transiting an airport in some place like Brussels and get arrested or detained or something. I think these fears are enormously exaggerated, but they're real enough so that to get American ratification of the International Criminal Court will take some work. Nonetheless, we should be supporting the effort, and if anything proves it, it's Karadzic and Bashir.
Let's see if we can get another question from the microphone here at the museum.
Hi, my name is Fran Lunny. I live in Alexandria, Virginia. And in your description of Karadzic as evil, did you feel that coming, emanating from him when you met him? What was his persona?
You know, it's a very good question. If you meet a person and you don't know they're evil, will you feel it? Well, in this case, it was the reverse. We knew this man was evil before we met him. So I can't tell if I could feel evil emanating from him because I knew he was evil or the reverse. It's a question psychiatrists and psychologists can ruminate on. All I know was if Hollywood was casting two war criminals, they couldn't do better than Ratko Mladic and Radovan Karadzic. They really looked the part.
Thanks very much for the question. Let's see if we can go now to... Line 6. Line 6 is Hucha. I think I've got that correct. Hucha calling us from Jacksonville, Florida. I hope I didn't mispronounce your name.
Hi, my name is Hucha, and I'm calling from Jacksonville, Florida. And I really appreciate to Mr. Holbrooke his words, for his absolutely right words, and his kindness. I am survivor from Srebrenica. And I was walking in Potocari. Mr. Holbrook, I think he's familiar with all these names. And when I see personally, probably 100 yards from myself, I see Ratko Mladic and with his guard and a couple of my cousins is already put in the bus, separate from his family. I was lucky that day. I don't know how. But I escaped through wire fence of United Nations from
compound there, yeah.
Nation troops. And I escaped from Srebrenica after 31 days. I was come in a territory of Kladanj. But I have one question. I would like to forget about that because they hurt me a lot. They're going to hurt me all my life. But I have one question. Did you, Mr. Holbrook, I know you are a main negotiator from United States, not just from United States, from all world. You represent human beings, human kindness at that time. And all our life, it was in your hand. Did you know, did you have anything in your on your heart, what's going to happen in Srebrenica? Before these negotiations with Ratko Mladic and Radovan Karadzic, did you know what's going to happen in Srebrenica? Or these two monsters, the monster, the devil, it was lying to you. Did you have any promise from them? Please give me answer from bottom of your heart. Not just
Nutcher, we're running out of time, so let's give Ambassador Holbrook a chance to respond.
Well, my heart goes out to you and to your family. I was in Srebrenica several times, most recently as a member of the United States delegation on the 10th anniversary of the terrible events you just described. I stood in the same spot you did in Potokari, in the factory there, and I prayed with the mothers and survivors in the fields as the bodies were reburied. To your question, I knew Srebrenica was the most dangerous place in Europe. 2 months before the tragedy that befell you and your friends and family, I talked directly to Dutch officials about it, including Her Majesty the Queen of the Netherlands. And I said to her at a conference when I sat next to her, I took out a napkin and I drew a map of Srebrenica and I said, look, here's the here's the town, here are the hills, here are your troops, here are the Serb gunners. You are in the most extreme danger and you must do something about it. I argued very strongly for reinforcing the UN forces there, not pulling them out. And then, when the Dutch started to pull out, I argued as strongly as I could that they should remain and we should bomb. But the Dutch, the British, and the French, had their troops at Garajda and Zeppa, two other towns
and
nearby,
we've just got,
which also spoke. They simply refused.
Ambassador Holbrook, I apologize, but we have to duck away. We have no time left. We'll pick this up another time. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.